Hello and welcome to this all-new Fast Talkers podcast, where we chat all things F1 and our panel ponders this week's biggest motorsport stories. Now, this isn't just any panel show. We've got together some of our favourite paddock people to try and bring you as close to the racing action as we can. And quite frankly, I miss my buddies. And if you've joined us from our YouTube channel already and watch Fast Talkers, then hopefully you already know what to expect. If you like the show, do subscribe to get the latest episodes straight to whichever device you use to listen to your podcasts. And thanks for listening. We have a wonderful panel for you today. Let me start by introducing you to a man who really needs no introduction. It is John Noble. He is F1 editor for motorsport.com. John, how are you? How bored are you on a scale of 1 to 10?
Probably nudging 11 at the moment. I think we really need the F1 season to get going pretty quickly, don't we? So if they can organise a few kind of non-championship rounds in the next few weeks, I think everyone would be very, very happy.
The threat of you saying that means more eSport. You are aware of this. Right, next up, we have former F1 mechanic. It is Mark Priestley. Hello to you, Mark. That is a very white panelled room that you're in.
It is, yeah. I'm all good, though. Thank you very much for having me. I'm a bit like John. It's I don't think I'm bored because I've got kids at home schooling. We're working from home. There's no room to get bored, but I am frustrated and desperate to get back into some sort of normality like the rest of us.
It does feel, although last year was the longest season we'd had in Formula One with the end almost on Christmas Day, seems like forever since we last had a race. Natasha Henry is a freelance journalist and broadcaster. How was it only kind of a month ago that we were racing in Formula One?
I don't know, but the sooner it comes back, the better, because I need something other than football to keep me going right now.
Yeah, so Natasha, you're the one of us who breaks away from just doing motorsport. You have other interests and you write and broadcast about other things. Is that actually quite a nice thing when the season ends that you can focus on different sport?
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, it's great to have that overlap because motorsport tends to cover the close season of football unless there's a tournament. And there's such different sports, such different characters. And, you know, being able to travel to different places is always a bonus.
Being able to travel anywhere right now would be a mega bonus.
Yeah.
John, have you been kept busy with F1 stories over the winter? I mean, not much has happened apart from a series of drivers getting COVID.
Yeah, it's not been too bad. The weird thing's been, because the season finished so late, the period of reflection has kind of rolled on a bit later as well. Normally, if the season finishes on December the 1st, you know, 3 weeks to look back at the season, reflect on it, interview people, speak to them, then Christmas, and then January the 1st, bang, you're straight into the new season. Whereas we kind of, the season finished, it was Christmas, everyone kind of gathered their thoughts again. And only now are we kind of just finishing off the analysis of last season. So I think we haven't quite flicked into full-on 2021 mode yet. There was a few little snippets, but I'm just waiting for one of the kind of the big announcements to kick it all into shape, really.
Well, announcements still to happen. We know that they're going to try for a 23 race calendar starting in Bahrain at the end of March. Australia's shuffled back 8 months to be in November. But we haven't heard about Lewis Hamilton. It's been very quiet. He was quiet on social media. He's popped back up again because he's, you know, off doing alpine skiing and training very hard, it looks like. But no contract yet. How weird is that, Natasha, for us to be in a state where we're in January and the only seat still spare is the top seat at Mercedes?
Yeah, it is a really weird situation. But at the same point, we know a contract's going to come. We know a contract's going to be signed. I think both parties want it. I'm guessing it's just the way COVID is affecting everything. Maybe they haven't had the opportunity to sit down like him and Toto did previously, sit down in the kitchen over a cup of coffee or tea, whatever they drink, and have a chat and thrash it out. But I think it creates a lot of speculation about his future. But then at the same point, there's nowhere else for him to go and there's no one else for them to put in his seat. And let's be honest, he wants that eighth world title. So we know Lewis is going to be there this year. My thing is, when he signs a contract, how long is he going to sign a contract for? Because I wonder if he'll sign a one-year contract with an option and possibly look to go and do another series rather than committing himself for maybe 2 or 3 years.
It is fascinating, isn't it? Because I don't think if it was anyone other than Lewis Hamilton, it wouldn't be generating as much speculation or as much interest as it has. But it is Lewis Hamilton. He's a 7-time world champion. The 8th world title, as Natasha just said, there is on the brink. It's within touching distance. And he knows that he's going to have a car that's probably capable of achieving that, given that there's, you know, limited technical transition between 2020 and 2021. Mercedes are almost certain to be at least up there, if not dominant. And so does he want to be able to exit the sport whenever he does, finally, as the undisputed most successful driver in terms of world titles in the history of the sport? I think unquestionably he does.
And John, you've been in the sport a long time. What do you think the holdup is? What have your sources said?
Yeah, I actually think that the delay in announcing it is a kind of a bit of an act of confidence that it is going to happen. I think as we saw with the Red Bull situation with Alex Albon last year, there were no options elsewhere for Hülkenberg and for Perez. So Red Bull could take their time. If there had been big seats available, the decision's rushed. So like with Lewis can't go anywhere else. Mercedes can't take anyone else. And there's no need to rush into the situation. Both want to continue. So I think it's just a question of getting Toto and Lewis around a table. I think they prefer to do this face-to-face than over a Zoom call. Maybe they could do it on a Fast Talkers, maybe. That would be a good exclusive for you.
I'll message Bradley, the PR guy, straight away and make that happen. I'm sure he'll come back with a yes.
Absolutely. So I think it's just a question of, you know, finalising a few details. And as Natasha said, last time I think was thrashed out in their kitchen and they did the deal in one lengthy meeting over one day. Then they went out for pizza in the evening. So, and with contracts, there's always little things to, you know, sort out here and there. There will be some pushback on some things from Lewis, and there'll be some pushback from aspects on Mercedes. But this is what negotiations are all about. I don't see it falling apart. And I do get quite amused when you kind of read stories about, you know, Lewis is asking for this amount of money and Mercedes is, you know, not willing to pay this amount. But, you know, when we discuss jobs with people, we don't let anyone else know what we're doing. So the likelihood of anyone really knowing, you know, what Lewis is asking for and what Mercedes are willing to pay for, yeah, I'm a bit skeptical about that.
I totally agree, John, in that the speculation that's been doing the rounds on the internet is literally just that, speculation. But I'm not sure I buy into this idea that it's just about finding a time to sit down. I mean, Mercedes have found time to do deals with Toto, with Ineos, about the entire structure of the organization. I mean, these are major talks. I mean, they've had to do that, presumably, in a virtual sense, I would imagine. So why can't they sit down with Lewis virtually if the basis of a contract is already there? He's had plenty of them with this organization before. What's the big holdup, do we think? I can't believe it's just about an extra zero on the end of his salary. So is it something to do with the restructuring of the organisation, or is it about length of contract, like Natasha suggested? There must be something for me that's a bit more of a sticking point than just finding time to sit down.
For me, I suspect, given the number of races we have this season, 23, well, hopefully 23, and we all know about Lewis's other interests, I wonder if one of the sticking points is him trying to ensure that he can do his fashion line, do the other things that he does around this ridiculously tight schedule that we're going to have. You know, there was always talk about what Lewis does outside of motorsport, but he's, the older he's got, the more proactive he's got in keeping up with his interests. So I definitely wonder if that's maybe where, you know, they may be butting heads or disagreeing slightly.
And there could be aspects related to the cost cap coming in. There's kind of changes in what teams campaign. I know the driver's salary is outside the cost cap for now, but, you know, there are budget considerations at Mercedes and the automotive industry. And if there is a driver's salary cap coming in 2 years' time or 3 years' time, you know, Lewis may feel, do I want to commit to a long-term contract now that's exempt from this driver salary cap, or do I go for a short-term contract now and risk this kind of salary cap cutting down my earnings in the future?
Do you think the George Russell stepping in towards the end of the 2020 season and doing such a good job has had any impact on the way that this negotiation, if it is indeed a negotiation, is going? Because Mercedes presumably have a little bit more bargaining power off the back of that, in that George stepped in with very little experience in that car and did a pretty impressive job.
Yeah, if I was Toto, I'd definitely be using them. Well, we'll just put George in then, and we can get these results. So it's definitely a little. I think it's a little bit of a tick box in Mercedes' favour on that front. But I don't think, I can't imagine for a second that Toto is threatening Lewis, saying,
no,
if you don't take a 50% pay cut, we're just going to whack George in the car.
No.
Maybe he's just waiting for his knighthood so that they can write Sir Lewis Hamilton on the contract.
Is he going to have that on his overalls, Sir Lewis Hamilton?
Well, in all honesty, what do we call him now? Like, as a broadcaster, this throws some real, like, conundrums into the mix, because at some point each broadcast, officially, we should probably call him Sir Lewis Hamilton. But Sir Lewis Hamilton comes around the final straight. Are your dogs going crazy now, Mark?
Yeah, you may have heard there's somebody at the door. Sorry about that.
We're going to let them go crazy. That's fine. They can have their say. How many dogs are there?
Two massive ones. You'd think I must live in some mansion with four kids and two dogs, but I don't. So we're all on top of each other. And anytime anybody shouts or speaks or barks, I'm afraid everyone else has to listen to it.
Okay, let's move on from Hamilton to talk about the calendar, because 23 races is what F1 have said they're hoping for. I didn't think they'd get 17 away last year, let's be honest, but 23 is what they've said, and they're sticking to it resolutely. And it means, I think, for the mechanics and engineers, more than anybody else, it is almost an impossible schedule. Mark, if you were still a mechanic, would you be looking at this going, it's not achievable?
I mean, not that it's not achievable, because Formula One people, I mean, never look at things like that. Everything's achievable. It's just how much are you willing to sacrifice and how you're going to go about achieving that. I mean, I know and still speak to a lot of my friends and former colleagues from McLaren and up and down the pit lane and off the back of last year, which, of course, last year they had a really long, frustrating period, as we all did, where nothing was happening for a large part of the season. And then it all came thick and fast. And that schedule, although it was shorter in terms of the length of time, it was really condensed and a lot of triple headers and that kind of thing. And those triple headers are incredibly hard on especially the people at the heart of a Formula One team, the mechanics, the people that are there the longest for every one of the events, the people that are probably working the longest hours, I would imagine, in the pit lane too. So I think everybody in Formula One saw last year as one of those years that, okay, we have to do the triple headers because it's a really weird and unique season. We've got to get this done. And if that's what it takes, we're all prepared to do that. But they definitely didn't want it to set a precedent for the future. And now we've gone into 2021. And of course, we're still under these really strange times, but we've now got an extended season, still including triple headers. And I know from talking to a lot of my mates, they're all very concerned that as this begins to expand even further, maybe up to 25 races, they're going to have to put more and more triple headers in, you know, just to enable those to happen. And that's really tough. So there is a definite concern from the teams and the people within the teams about the schedule and how it might impact not just them, of course, but their families and friends and life outside of racing, of which some of them do have one. It's really tough on those people. So I do think there is beginning to be a recognition from the people at the top of Formula One that is a challenge. And the teams themselves are now having to look at how they manage that. So do they start rotating people throughout the season? Can they start looking at bringing people out later to a Grand Prix and sending them home perhaps on a Sunday night rather than a Monday or a Tuesday? So those little details do make a difference when you add up all of the time away over the course of an entire Grand Prix calendar year.
Well, I do wonder if the way this calendar's been constructed is with one mind on COVID and, you know, the ongoing uncertainties we have. Because I think they kind of had to put a calendar out to show that the F1 plan was there. But I think realistically, they know this current schedule isn't going to be set in stone. I think if you need flexibility, the best way to do it is to have a really crammed calendar, and then you can pull events out as they fall out. Then you haven't got these huge gaps to try and shuffle one around. If you had a calendar with a race every 3 weeks and you lost a race, then suddenly you go, well, how are we going to fill this 6 week gap? So I think it may look a bit strange now, but I think the reality as we go on is I think we'll have a first half of the season that, you know, should play out. I still think races like Monaco and Baku will be tough to do if the COVID situation hasn't improved a lot over the next few months. But I think when you look at the back end of the season, it's been much more difficult to, you know, go to Mexico, to go to Brazil, even America. So I think flexibility is probably the key to what we see at the moment.
Yeah, and the other thing about that is that this year in 2021 is, you know, it's a season, a standalone season in its own, but it's also a strange season in that we're building up to some of the biggest changes that Formula One has ever experienced in recent memory as we go into 2022, where the cars are different, the rules are different. It's a huge challenge for a Formula One team. So they've got a huge part of their resource and a huge eye on 2022, as much as they have, perhaps even more than they have on 21. So if we start having to be flexible in the calendar, and even if it starts to shuffle backwards, if we have to tag a race onto the end and that gap between the end of one season finishing and the next one starting gets even shorter, that might have an even bigger impact perhaps than it might in a normal season.
I think in a way, COVID might actually be a positive thing for the working conditions. I think people underestimate, you know, the mechanics, the engineers, how much of their life goes into working for a Formula One team. And like Mark said, like maybe think overlapping people or doing alternate races or letting people leave early. Maybe COVID is reminding us that, you know, work-life balance is a bit more important. These people do need time with their families. They do need rest days. Obviously, it's hard for the drivers, but the drivers maybe get to chill and get on their private jet and fly to wherever they want to fly, whereas the engineer is traveling from race to race to race and may not see his kids and his partner or her partner for, you know, weeks at a time. So hopefully it will make us, you know, maybe look at the commitment that people are putting into motorsport, into F1, and change how we work, more flexible working possibly.
I certainly think when I've spoken to some of the mechanics and engineers, they've said the sacrifices they made to get the 2020 season away were vast. Some of them didn't see their families at all. From the entire time that they started the first race of the kind of revised season to the last race, they just didn't go home because they didn't want to, you know, have the risk of picking up COVID. We saw
there'll be
drivers...
there'll be some people watching this in the middle of a lockdown thinking, that sounds amazing.
That is very true. Very true. But I mean, it was one hell of a sacrifice. And you must all remember when we did the last triple header, they were like, no more triple headers. And now we've got a season with really intense triple headers. And if they go ahead, you know, the likes of Russia, Singapore, Japan, a triple header of those three, we all know those three are difficult races to do at the best of times. That is going to be exhausting for everybody. And as a journalist, I'm not allowed to moan because I have the best job in the world, but...
I was on the phone actually just a couple of days ago to somebody from one of the Formula One teams, and they, having looked at the calendar, they said exactly that about Singapore. Everybody in the industry says Singapore needs to always be a standalone race. It shouldn't be back to back. It definitely shouldn't be part of a triple header, because the logistics of getting there and set up and then getting away are so much different to others. I mean, there are others a bit like that, but Singapore particularly should always be just on its own. If you talk to anybody in a Formula One team, and now it's part of this triple header scenario. So those challenges are going to be huge. And you look at it on a sheet of paper. And of course, for most fans, the appreciation of actually what has to happen to make that race, you know, go off smoothly is difficult to appreciate. But when you're inside that little circle, you look at that sheet of paper, that calendar, and you think, oh my God, why have they done that?
So testing starts a little bit later. The first race of the season will be in Bahrain. That'll be Italy. We've still got a TBC for the beginning of May. We're expecting that to be Portimao, and then on to Spain, Monaco, Azerbaijan, Canada. And it's a very familiar territory. But we saw last season a lot of the, you know, the races happened in Europe. It made it very easy for everybody. Do you think, John, by the end of the year, we'll look back and reflect and actually... the season will once again be European dominated?
I think so. I think, you know, looking at, you know, it's still a fast changing situation with COVID. Now the variants are causing more complications. I saw a story this morning that UK government's considering shutting the UK borders completely, which would throw a huge spanner in the works, especially for Renault, if you're trying to move parts and equipment across, if it's a complete border lockdown. So even though the vaccine's rolling out, you know, I don't think it's going to be an instant, suddenly everyone's vaccinated and the world can get back to normal. So I still think we're talking about the summer. We saw Glastonbury was cancelled yesterday. The Tokyo Olympics are looking very, very doubtful now. So I think in the end it will be a European-centric calendar, and that those events where you can adopt a biosphere, like they had in Abu Dhabi last year, where you can just keep the F1 community all locked up together, basically, keep them away from the cities and the towns around them and the people around them, and just operate around the track. You can do those. You can do in Abu Dhabi. You can do Bahrain. You can do potentially, you know, could Singapore lock off a part of the city and do it that way around? So there are possibilities there. But I think in the end, some of the flyaways are going to be just impossible to do.
Let's try and look at something positive. You mentioned Renault, Fernando Alonso back in Formula One. Natasha, what are your thoughts about the two times world champion re-entering the arena?
I think it's quite funny that I remember when he left and he said he would leave if there was more than 20 races, I think it was. And now he's coming back in a season where there's 23. I mean, you know, for the sport, it's great. And for us as journalists, it's always great because he's going to give you a line and a narrative. And the fans love to see a character in any sport. And he's definitely that. But I do wonder if he can reach those heights that we've previously seen him reach. I mean, I said before when we spoke about him before, you can see it's an obsession for him. Motorsport is an obsession. And I don't want to see him come back and be really disappointing because, you know, no one wants to see a miserable Fernando Alonso, do they? We want to see him on the podium. We want to see him happy. But, I mean, he hasn't... When did he last win a race? Was it 2014 was his last podium for Ferrari? That's a long time, you know. When you've got the likes of Verstappen, Lewis, obviously, Leclerc, is he going to come back and be fighting with those boys at the front of the grid, or is he just going to be mid-table and kind of limping around tracks?
It's a very good point. I totally agree. I think he's box office. You know, it's great, like you say, for the sport. I think it's interesting in that he's coming into a team that is pretty much a midfield team. And if you look at the results, certainly the way the order of the championship finished, it was probably quite disappointing in the end for Renault. Yet they showed some signs of positive growth, didn't they? Showed some, well, podium opportunities and things like that. And it will be great if they can continue that momentum and Fernando can be part of that. If you look at Daniel Ricciardo, I would probably rate him up there in the similar band of driver talent. One of the top tier drivers for me, Daniel Ricciardo, he managed to drag that car into, you know, podium contention on occasion last year. You would expect that Fernando, once he's built himself back up to speed, could probably do similar things with the car. So if we can see Fernando fighting for podiums on occasions, you know, that for me is okay. That's enough from a fan perspective to keep the interest, and that's what we want to see. If you don't see that, and it is on a knife edge at Renault, they're on the cusp of being, on some days, very competitive, on others, really uncompetitive. And I think what's going to be most interesting is on those days when he's not competitive, when the car is at the back of that midfield order, as it sometimes I'm sure will be, how will he react? You know, he's a driver that I think sees himself, probably justifiably, right up the top, up there with a Lewis Hamilton in terms of his stature within the sport. And yet his results this year are probably not going to be on a par with that of Lewis Hamilton. You can see, and we've seen it in the past, when that plays out in the world of Fernando Alonso, it can all go horribly wrong very quickly. But believe me, I've seen it myself up close.
I think the key is going to be whether that end of season, just slight dip in form from Renault, whether that was a blip or whether it was a sign of something big. Because since this kind of Silverstone phase, you know, Daniel talked about this setup breakthrough they made on the car. They're bringing good aero parts to the car. Really good momentum. They got three podiums. Daniel got two and Esteban got the one in Sakhir. It was all, you know, rolling on. They were looked favourite for third place. And then it just fell away. So there'll be a lot of analysis. One thing I want to ask you, Mark, is the kind of the winter period for us journalists. You know, we can talk about speculation and the momentum of the end of last season and how the teams are looking. But when you're inside a team, how do you feel in the winter when, you know, you're working your guts off to, you know, produce the best car possible and do stuff, but you don't know what everyone else is doing? How do you know if you're doing a good job, or how do you know where things are going and if it's feeling good, or is it just endless sleepless nights wandering?
Well, yeah, when you first said, how do you feel that in the winter? Knackered is the answer. It's a really good point, because the truth is you don't really know. And you know, when you're working inside a team, we read all the stuff that you guys write and as much as everybody else does. So we see the speculation. We see other teams coming out saying, yeah, we've got a new engine that's delivering us another 10, 20 horsepower. You know, things are looking great. You start to read that, and some people read that as gospel and say, well, wow, Ferrari is suddenly going to be back up the top. Or inside the team, we tend to, I don't want to disrespect you by saying we ignore what you write, but we take it all with a pinch of salt, because we know and we see people writing about us with predictions or prophecies of what's going to happen. And we're thinking, how on earth could they possibly know that? Because we don't even know that. The only thing you're able to do over the course of the winter is find progression from where you left off. So if you've improved your own car and your own performance in every single area, that's when things start to, you find an air of positivity, because that's not a given. You know, there are some areas where you'll improve. There are other areas where you really struggle to take a leap forward. And those moments can be really frustrating inside a team. And that definitely trickles down throughout the factory. People know that. People discuss it at coffee breaks and at lunchtimes. And when you mingle within departments, you know if the aero department have really struggled to find the gains that they believe they set out to achieve or needed to achieve. So you definitely feel a sort of air of a status within the organization of how you think you've progressed. But as you rightly say, until you get to pre-season testing, and actually really until you get to the first Grand Prix, you actually have no idea what anyone else is doing, because the smart people are never going to come out and tell you what they've achieved or what they've done or how many more horsepower they've found or aero points. You know, these things just are not made public. So it's totally top secret, just like we're keeping it all top secret within our own closed doors as well. So you're right. You know, you just work to do the best you can and improve on the baseline that you have, because that's your previous year's performance or how you started the year in the wind tunnel with this first iteration of this new car, how much have improved since that came out. Those are the benchmarks, or the only benchmarks that we can measure ourselves on. So on that basis, you can get to the first test or the first race and either be massively positively surprised, or you can be hit with a bombshell that actually, when you thought you were doing okay, everyone else has done much better.
Will it change things because Bahrain is now the first race? Obviously, we're kind of used to going to Australia, having a funky monkey race, because it's always strange in Australia. But do you think, Mark, that Bahrain will turn into a straight, can it get stranger than last year? I don't know, a massive fireball in the sky, maybe not. But will it be a stranger race than we're used to because it's the first race?
I think it'll be a less strange race. There's two reasons. First of all, we're testing there now. So pre-season testing now happens at the same track that we're about to go racing on a couple of weeks later. That means that we're going to be better prepared for that race event, because we've been able to not just test the new cars like we normally would around Barcelona, but we can actually work on race setups and tyre preparation for that specific circuit. That perhaps, you could say, takes away some of the variability or the unpredictability, excuse the dogs, takes away some of the unpredictability that actually, as fans, we kind of love from the first race, because it can throw up a surprise. So there's that one. I think we might find that teams are a little bit better prepared. And the other thing is that because it's been pushed back by a couple of weeks, that's invaluable time. I mean, I can tell you that the teams are loving that decision, because even a few days or an extra week before your first test or before your first race, an extra couple of weeks in the wind tunnel or in the simulation departments of a Formula One team, or even in production, getting spares manufactured, that's huge and makes a massive, massive difference to not only how well you're prepared, but how many spares you're able to bring to a race, for example. So if you do have a disaster in testing, you're not massively hampered and having to revert back to an old front wing, for example, because you were able to manufacture enough of the new ones.
John, when it comes to testing, obviously we're used to Spain and we're used to 6 days of testing. This is only going to be 3 in up Bahrain. Do you think only having 3 days of testing will mean more problems for people in Bahrain?
Potentially more problems. But I think it's going to punish you harder if you haven't got things sorted straight away. We've seen teams in the past, like Mercedes, for example, would run a very basic car first week of testing, so you do all your reliability running, endurance running, check everything's working, and then second test, bring all the aero bits on, and then you're away. You can't do that this time. You've got to pretty much attack it from day one. 1.5 days for each driver. If you lose a day because there's an engine problem or a mechanical problem or something's gone wrong, if you know, your aero package isn't working and you need to fly some spares out, you've got this huge lag delay. You can't just do what you could do for Barcelona. So I think there will be fresh demands. But as Mark says, I think the delay will help. But they can be assured of pretty consistent conditions. There shouldn't be, you know, be more relevant to the first race. And I think there's quite a nice quirk of when Bahrain holds a season opener, F1 will have had 3 out of 4 races in Bahrain. It's just incredible.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen very often, does it? Natasha, when it comes to you looking at the drivers, obviously there are some big movements, but actually the biggest movement was probably with Cyril Abitbol not staying on at Renault and them having a whole reshuffle. Is that the Alonso effect, do you think, starting to take place?
Yeah, I think we can't underestimate Alonso coming back to, well, I mean, third time lucky, isn't it? Can't underestimate him coming back to the team. I do wonder if just having someone like Alonso as your driver on track is going to make everyone in that team work harder. You're bringing in a name like that, everyone wants to elevate themselves. And I think his experience, his knowledge, his ego, his attitude, you know, is going to spread across the whole team from, you know, from engineers upwards, if we want to say. You do wonder how much power he's going to have, which I think is why he will compliment someone like Daniel Ricciardo, who's a lot more chilled, who's very relaxed. I'm very interested to see how they bounce off each other, actually, because they're very different characters.
Yeah, I'll be intrigued to know how the kind of the Alonso approach to kind of dealing with teams and motivating people and, you know, being so ruthless and determined, and if things aren't going right, you know, stamping your fist on the table, as opposed to Daniel's more kind of laid back approach. But Pat Fry said last year, one of Daniel's strengths is, you know, he understands everything. He's, you know, boosts the team. If they have bad days, he's firing everybody up, saying, right, we'll learn from this and we'll push on. You know, it's a very positive mentality. Whereas I think Fernando sometimes, if he gets aggressive and determined, you know, can bring a bit of negativity into the system. So it'll be interesting to see how Renault cope with a different personality, you know, behind closed doors and in those debrief rooms.
Especially with the new organisation as well, because of course Daniel's gone, but as you said there, so is Cyril. So we've got a new management structure who are all probably having to work out not only the organisation, but now the influx of a Fernando Alonso and whatever effect he brings in this stage of his career.
I'll never forget, I think it was in Bahrain, probably about 6 years ago, and I was having a off the record conversation with an engineer who no longer works in the sport, so I'm probably okay in saying this, but they sort of, I said, oh, how are things going, just quite casually, and they said, oh, it's hard work in that garage. And I was like, why? So it's the Ferrari garage at the time. You thought everything was going to be okay, Kimi, Fernando. I said, one of those kids is throwing their toys out the pram. And I automatically at that stage went, oh, it must be Kimi's having a nightmare. It was not Kimi. Fernando Alonso is hard to work with. And Mark, he can be quite a dangerous personality to have in a garage, to have in a team. Look at the destruction that he created at McLaren when he was alongside Hamilton.
Well, that's my experience of working with Fernando is exactly that. It was divisive. It was destructive. There were a number of reasons behind it, but that was I only worked with him for one season, of course, before he left pretty unceremoniously. But that was my experience. And, you know, I wrote about this quite extensively in my book because it was such an interesting insight into his character, not just how he approached Grand Prix racing, but how he dealt with adversity. And I'll absolutely accept that this was quite some years ago and he will have absolutely matured and moved on, because in the same way, Lewis Hamilton made a huge number of mistakes behind the scenes in that particular year when they were up against each other too. He also has gone on to mature and change as a person. So I wouldn't want to say my experience in 2007 is probably or necessarily reflective of what the guys at Renault will see now. But what happened in that season was when he went up against Lewis and the results didn't go his way, he very quickly began looking for reasons why that was happening, because it couldn't possibly have been that Fernando wasn't performing well enough. There must have been another reason. So was it that the team was turning against him and favouring Lewis Hamilton? Was it that Lewis was up to no good or doing something dodgy? And there were all these kind of scenarios going on. And the effect that has, to cut the long story short, is that it disseminates through the team. And if your driver is showing negativity or, you know, an air of sort of, I don't want to say arrogance, but, you know, a sort of disagreement within the organization, a distrust of his own team, that very quickly, you know, reflects on the people within it. And the people within that team begin to distrust, you know, that driver. And you almost end up with the camp splitting, which is the worst possible case scenario. So I hope that that's not going to be the case anymore. And I know he had troubles at Ferrari as well. So it's clearly a part of his personality. But yes, he's had a couple of years away to reflect on things. And he's coming back, perhaps without so much pressure on his shoulders. He's already got his two world championships. He's got a certain status within the sport. He doesn't need to prove himself, I guess, to anybody, apart from to himself, perhaps. And that will be the interesting thing as to how that plays out, depending on results and the adversity that he might face.
John?
Yeah, I think the new management will be interesting. I think it's fairly obvious that Luca de Meo, the new Renault CEO, means business. When we, you know, when he arrived, we didn't really know much about him. But it was a Monza last year where we had a briefing with him where he launched the whole Alpine thing. He's passionate about motor racing. You know, he's got some grand ambitions for this. He's revamped the whole Renault car company in 6 months, this grand renolution, as they call it. You know, it means business. When we first heard that, you know, David Brivio was going to be lured across from Suzuki, it just seemed surreal that this was something that doesn't really happen. People have gone from, you know, their F1 careers have fizzled out and they've gone into MotoGP, but very rarely, I can't think of any big figures, you haven't taken a top MotoGP boss and brought him across to Formula One. So I think it's a statement of intent from Alpine. I'd like to know more about the real background of what's happened with Cyril, why Brivio's role hasn't yet been fully defined, because you know, it's quite a interesting statement saying that we haven't yet decided what his roles and responsibilities will be. So still some uncertainty there. But I think Fernando is going to push it on hard. He isn't going to sit back this year and just be relaxed and think, well, 2022 is coming, that's fine, I'll wait till then. He means business from day one, basically. So I think it will be fascinating to see how it goes, and especially that form of the car at those first races of the season, because if it starts well, you'll see a fired up, excited Fernando. If they have some stumbles, there'll be some problems.
Jenny, weren't you the most high profile transfer from MotoGP to Formula One back in the day?
Oh, I think Susie Perry might have outdrunk me there as well. Who knows? Maybe. But I have to say, Brivio was brilliant. When I had anything to do with him in MotoGP, I came away and was thoroughly impressed by him, by his team, by the organisation. And when I heard that he was coming across, I thought that is great news. Because F1 shouldn't just be insular. It should go outside the bracket. And look how it's happened at McLaren. They've brought in Andreas Seidel from WEC. And that has been revolutionary to that team. He's galvanized them. He's brought in new thinking, new ideas, new ways of working. And it's worked for them. And I hope that when Brivio comes in, he can do something similar. Because a lot of the time, we're in this little bubble. And you can't raise the ceiling because everybody's in the same room. You bring in someone from outside of that and the MotoGP world, it's a totally different way of thinking, a totally different way of operating. And I can only think that cross-pollination will be good. And let's face it, if you've come from MotoGP like me, bound to be a classic. No,
I think you're absolutely right. Formula One can often be a victim of being really insular and actually quite arrogant as an industry, thinking that there can't be anybody better than us because we're Formula One. And that is a thing that I've seen run through a lot of teams and even the infrastructure around Formula One. So to open that up to accept ideas from outside, I think is a really powerful thing. And like you say, could end up bearing some big fruits, hopefully. John, I was just going to quickly ask you, what do you think about the way this was all communicated? Because as you touched on there, when they announced his appointment, it was sort of caveated with a line in the press release saying we'll release what he's going to be doing or what his role will entail over the next few weeks. That seems like a strange way to announce somebody. We've employed this guy, but we haven't worked out what he's going to do yet.
Well, I may have played a slightly guilty role in scuppering a bit of this, because we broke the story that Brivio was on his way to Alpine. And normally teams like to have everything all kind of pre-planned, that this is happening, the roles, we'll do this press release on this day, and then us nasty journalists kind of get whiff on it, announce it, and then suddenly there's a bit more pressure in the system to do things. So I know when, for example, when Andreas Seidel was announced that he was leaving WEC, you know, no team had been identified. There were some suspicions. So the focus wasn't on anybody in particular. And McLaren had done quite a good job of batting stuff away till he was announced and they explained what his position was. Whereas I think Alpine's a slightly different scenario, because from day one, we had that he was going there. So it may have been a bit of, they've had to do something in response.
It's your fault,
to everyone,
basically.
Everyone accepting it, all my fault.
Yeah.
But because equally, I think, you know, it's announced at 9:30 on a Sunday morning as well, which is often think when stuff's announced is very indicative of when, if you want to bury a story, there are certain times to do it. I mean, we all know when, you know, testing finished last year, I think it was 5 p.m. or 6 p.m. in Barcelona.
Yeah.
FI puts a press release out about the private arrangement with Ferrari over the previous season's engine. So it's obviously a deliberate attempt to bury bad news. So if you want to keep a press release kind of quiet and stop speculation, announce it on a Sunday morning when most people are in their pajamas or still in bed. So I think maybe they've had to been forced to do something and forced to get out just to kill off the talk.
See, okay. Normally, John, they do that when you're on a plane.
Yes, exactly.
But you've not been on a plane long, they gave up waiting.
I can't remember the last time I was on a plane, actually. Maybe back from Monza last year or something, or the post-Italian GP, so a long time.
Yeah, I haven't been on a plane since I came back from Australia for my 32-hour trip.
Wow.
Been a long time. Suitcase has gone up in the loft.
Wow.
Given up. And that's all we got time for. Thank you so much to John, to Mark, and to Natasha for joining us. Hopefully you've enjoyed a little foray into F1 and a look ahead to the 2021 season. And I'm just going to round up by asking, how many races do you think will make up this season? I'm going to go John, Mark, then Natasha.
19.
20.
18.
I'm going to go 17. I'm going to go with a replica from last year just because I can. But fingers crossed, we just get a great season. I don't care how many races, as long as it's a really good season.
Yeah.
Right. As I said, thanks to John. Thanks to Mark. Thanks to Natasha. Thanks for joining us on Fast Talkers. And we'll see you again very soon.